living beings in this world need us to do this practice. They're pleading with us to do this practice. They might not know that they're pleading, but I think it's what they really want. And it's the greatest gift we can give to others. This practice and this sesshin, the practice is being presented as opening to the non-duality of mind and object. So, people as objects to our mind need us to open to and realize that they are not separate from us, from our mind. The greatest gift we can give others is to realize that they are our mind. To truly fulfill our bodhisattva vows. Now, if we ask the average person on the street, I have a choice of three gifts I could give you. Which would you choose? A check for $10,000, a vacation to Hawaii, or me to realize that you're my mind. How many would choose option three? But if they really knew how this works, they wouldn't hesitate. Because $10,000 and a trip to Hawaii are also just mine. No different, really, from one penny or a trip 5 feet down the sidewalk. But because we have great difficulty believing this, we suffer. So, just to emphasize again that this mind-only teaching is for benefiting others, and it's for freeing ourself and everyone from our difficulties and our suffering. If we lose that context, it just kind of becomes kind of like just strange mind games and play. And also, even if it feels like it's not just play, this is really interesting to explore, I think we won't have the motivation, the intensity of motivation and aspiration and intention to keep deeply boring into these teachings and with great diligent effort to try to open this mind to reveal such a truth. If it's just for me, and I don't really believe maybe that it'll really help me that much, we'll probably lose interest pretty quickly if we haven't already. So it may be hard to get to this point of how we feel like, and this would apply to any Dharma teaching really, but to see that you know, any like ultimately liberating Dharma teaching, of which I would say this is one, without trusting that that's so, and that it really is of the greatest benefit, we probably won't be able to sustain the diligence required. I find this in myself, you know, I can even be studying it and but lose sight of this basic purpose and the bodhisattva compassionate aspect and you know, lose energy or lose interest or whatever. Doesn't mean that we don't get bored or that we don't need breaks, because bodhisattvas have to take breaks. They have to be well rested because it's hard work to be a bodhisattva. Good rest gives us a chance to be more energetic when we're at bodhisattva work. And seeing how this works with our own suffering, you know, it may be clear already. I don't know how clear it is to people, but I think there's practical exercises, you know, we can try in Zazen and outside of Zazen, like when basically we have the sense that something is difficult or we're having some problem or there's some discontent, large or small. During Zazen's a nice time because we have nothing else to do, particularly. And because probably sometime in the course of a day of sitting, there'll be at least a moment of two or two of discontent. And if we can't find quite a bit of it, we may be gone numb or something because it's pretty accessible all the time, pretty much all the time on some level. So we can find that, locate some difficulty, then, you know, if we, to get really kind of step by step, we could say, what are we grasping? And this would apply to not just mind only, this is basic Buddha Dharma. It's like if there's discontent, it means that the mind is mentally grasping, attaching to some idea, feeling, thought. Even feeling is, I think when we're really grasping it, it's become more of an idea. Almost always, I think we might be able to say it's especially in terms of mind only, we're grasping some mental image of something. And I think all Buddhist schools would agree with this. And, you know, we've all heard this many times, but I think it's good to remember many, 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 many times this basic point that, like, suffering equals grasping mental objects. Most people who've never heard of Buddha Dharma have no idea that this is the case. And even we might have heard this or not heard this, but even if we've heard it many times, we might still feel like, I'm not totally convinced of that. So I'd say that's, like, in a way a first step. And if we're not convinced of that, then maybe, like, in a way, maybe we should stop. You can stop listening to anything else I'm saying and just contemplate that, because I think that's the starting point. This basic conclusion that, like, suffering of ourselves and others always has this aspect, this essential aspect of it's you know, grasping a mental image. It's the mind grasping an aspect of the mind, actually. And grasping is, you know, what is that exactly? I think we feel it in a physical way, usually, and a mental way, and it's what we call suffering. Any type of, like, I'm not totally at ease and content right now. So whatever stirrings there are that are not completely at ease and content, ready to die in the moment, that's what we would call suffering. Maybe very small, but and that is always not so much caused by, no, technically, not so much caused by mental grasping of mental images, but it is mental grasping of mental images. It's like, that's the definition, as we hear in the setting in motion, the wheel of Dharma Sutra that we chant in the mornings, the Buddha's first teaching ever, which all his other teachings are elaborations on. Birth is suffering, death is suffering, aging, sickness, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair, separation from the pleasant, being apart from the pleasant, separation from the pleasant, being with the unpleasant, not getting what we want. All these are suffering. In brief, wrapping them all into one, summarizing them all, grasping the five skandhas is suffering. Not actually the cause, but that's the definition of discontent. We might say, yeah, I know, but like, how can we remember this again and again? Because it's so important. And then we have all these amazing tools to address this sentence from the first sutra that, in brief, basically grasping the five skandhas is, you know, body-mind experience is suffering. So then we have this mind-only system that's like based on this point. It's like medicine for this basic sickness. And there's lots of different kinds of medicine. But when we, in our experience in Zazen or whatever, when we're sensing, okay, I got a moment of discontent here. Can I see how it's grasping a mental image? That's like step one. And it's a big step, and if we're not used to looking in that way, that might take a while. But, and it's actually a huge step. That's like half the process already. It's like, oh, I actually see that this anguish I'm going through is I'm grasping a mental image. You know, if we've already heard a lot of these teachings without doing that step, and maybe that step is like 90% of the way already, like, okay, I get it. But it may be like, yeah, I'm grasping a mental image, but like, I'm not gonna let go of it. And like, and I see that that's what's happening, but it's not resolving this issue. So then we have all these teachings of mind only to just keep confirming this truth that what we're grasping is always mind. It's not actually external objects. If it were external objects that we're grasping, there may be no hope, actually. There may be like, it may be impossible to end suffering. Right? Because, except for maybe just like try to like relax the grasping of this mental object, even though it's gonna probably keep happening because this, I mean, not of the mental object, of the actually external object. Just stop grasping this external object. But as long as we see it as external, I would say, like, we'll never actually be able to really let go of it. That's kind of maybe a big statement that's important. When, as long as we see what we're grasping as truly external, even slightly, then we won't be able to ever let go. Our relationship to it will be somewhat painful, inevitably, because it's separated. There's a separation. So grasping can take many, many forms. In this case, if there's this subject object duality, it might mean like we're literally like trying to there's this external stick out here and I really want it, and so I'm like meant that I really want that object. But it might, the grasping can also take the form of aversion, exactly the opposite, like get this stick, is always here, you know, it keeps appearing here, can't get it away, destroy it. Same thing, right? It's like there's, if there's a duality between the self and the object, it's there's this uncomfortable tension. Even so, that's like the the positive and negative relationships, and then you could even a neutral relationship, like I could take it or leave it. it's a stick here. It's not troubling me. Like I don't really want it or really want to get rid of it. I mean, that's the most peaceful. But I think in terms of these mind-only teachings, that there's still very subtly not quite the perfect piece of nirvana going on here with this relationship. Even though I'm like, it's pretty neutral, I'm pretty equanimous with it, it's still, if I still see it as outside the mind a little bit, it's kind of troubling. And this might be really hard to see this point, so I wouldn't worry about it too much, unless we get, get really neutral about most stuff and we're not getting into a lot of the positive and negative, then that might be a good time to start examining how these neutral experiences are still suffering. It's like, I think when the Buddha talked about these three kinds of suffering in the early teachings, the suffering of suffering, right, which is the obvious one, the suffering of painful situations. And then the Buddha said, then there's the suffering of pleasurable, pleasant situations, which is the fact that they're impermanent and unreliable and unstable. And then this third type is the all-pervasive suffering of like being a conditioned sentient being. You know, it's different ways to talk about that, but it's the one that's basically when the other two are like not really operating and things are going pretty well. Buddha's saying that there's this third type that's like all-pervasive. It's like as long as we're not fully realized Buddha, it's like it's pervading all our even neutral experiences. And in terms of mind only, we could talk about that as this point that it's the suffering from just relating to very neutral objects as external to mind, the suffering of the apparent world of duality, also called samsara. So we might think, well, why should we try to dig up all this suffering that we're not even aware of? Shouldn't we try to minimize it? But it's kind of the opposite, right? It's like saying, let's actually admit and acknowledge the non-peaceful aspects of just daily life. And I think it's maybe not so good to acknowledge them if we don't want to actually fully take up this practice, because then maybe we'll make it worse. But if we have this bodhisattva vow, like, I really want to, like, take this as far as it will go, in, you know, however long it takes, this is my path, then I think it's good to actually bring up the, you know, all of it, and to see how vast and endless this path is. The bodhisattva way is endless and deeply subtle, right? The way that neutral things are somewhat painful. All the time. And then we can start, then that gives us maybe some fuel for these contemplations. Okay, I can see how maybe this is actually so, that the problem is actually bigger than I had first thought. I just came to this practice because I was, like, really suffering, and, like, it's worked pretty well, actually. It's relieved a lot of it, and I'm actually much happier as a practitioner now. And so, isn't that enough? And the bodhisattva vow would be like, no, it's never enough. It's until all beings are completely free from the slightest dis-ease, with the slightest event. I think we shouldn't get anxious about this either and be like, oh man, this is like, I didn't sign up for this course when I took those vows. This is, it's way beyond me. I'd rather please not think about this anymore. Can we go on to something else? So, yeah, let's not get overwhelmed in a depressing kind of way, but I think I'm, for myself, I can see how there's a lot to do. I feel like my practice is just scratching the surface, this tiny little bit, but I feel so joyful about doing that. And continuing, and sometimes I can get into the space of feeling like in a hurry, or like I gotta like stop wasting time, and there's like this life is too short to and there's too much dharma to understand, and like I keep just getting distracted, but be patient with ourselves and just keep going with the joy that we're just going in generally a good direction through the fog and mist, where we keep losing the path and it's all overgrown in the fog and it's starting to rain harder and it's getting dark and but it's okay. We'll just keep going slowly, really slowly, just step by step. So if the first step is noticing how our difficulties are actually grasping something, then we can start investigating the objects that we seem to be grasping. What are they? Or what is their relationship to the mind, or are they actually external to the mind? And so that's now what we've been talking about. It's putting it all in the context again. Important to remember the context. When we, as we get into this sutra, on the reading list, I think for commentary on chapter 6 of the Sandinir Mochana Sutra, which is basically the three characteristics of phenomena. There's Jeffrey Hopkins wrote this trilogy of basically on, you know, each book is, this one's about 600 pages, there's three volumes about 600 pages each, all on the three natures as presented in this one page chapter of the Sandinir Mochana Sutra, which in itself is like, wow, what? How could somebody say that much about one page of a sutra? But he somehow managed to do this. And I feel like sometime I want to meet Jeffrey Hopkins. He's an amazing scholar, and I think maybe not so much of like a retreat kind of practitioner, but the bodhisattva vow that he must have to actually sit down and write this stuff out is awesome to me. He's also before this trilogy, he wrote this big volume called Meditation on Emptiness and Emptiness Yoga, that's more the emptiness in the middle way, Madhyamaka view of Nagarjuna. So that was really his thing for many years. And instead of just staying with that, I mean, he, you know, for studying that Madhyamaka view, I think that's almost like the Bible for that, you know, the really extensive, elaborated commentaries on that mode. He could have said, that's my life's work. And I think a lot of people said, like, this is Jeffrey Hopkins' magnus opus, Meditation on Emptiness. And it's kind of like sub-commentary called Emptiness Yoga. He could have just stopped there, but then he said, now let's do mind only. Or like through his exploration of that system, I think he started seeing how it's related to mind only in these ways. So it's a little divergence, but just my own inspiration around this guy, Jeffrey Hopkins, who, I don't know whether I should say I recommend reading this stuff even, because I think if you want to get really into this over a long time, this trilogy is nice, and the second volume of the three is my favorite. This one's called Reflections on Reality. The third volume is called Absorption in No External World. That is the title itself. Absorption in No External World. The subtitle is 170 Issues in Mind-Only Buddhism. So, like a lot of the questions that are coming up for us, there's these naturally questions arising. These are the 170 issues that he came up with and various responses to them. But in a way, actually, particularly, it's 170 issues around the three natures or the three characteristics. And this subtitle is the three natures and non-natures in the mind-only school. So there's a lot, and we haven't even gotten into what the three natures are, and I'm saving it for the class. But I just thought he's got these really nice appendices in here, a few hundred pages of appendices on basically mind only and idealism. So is mere concept compatible with external objects? You know, this is kind of some of the stuff that we're talking about these days, and it's too long for me to have read during Sesshin, but he addresses a lot of these issues, and it's the kind of reading that it's like every sentence you have to read like a few times because they're so dense and difficult. It's not easy going. So I haven't read through all of these books. They're way heavy duty, but he's very careful about every word he chooses to like be very, very accurate. So when it seems like this system is starts sounding a little kind of like wishy-washy and like, well, there's no external world, but like, that's a kind of nice idea, but like, I think this, we haven't really thought through this completely. If you want to think through it completely, people have done this. And they try to present the system as it's, you know, traditionally presented. He's pretty unbiased. I mean, he'll say, when he has his own opinions, he'll say, this is my opinion, but he's really like, this is how the system is presented by the Sandinirmochana Sutra and Asanga and Vasubandhu, the founders of the mind-only school, and then all these later generations of Tibetan scholars. But I just thought this little section I just happened to come upon about, again, we have these Western philosophical terms and it would be good to have a dictionary. But we talked about this term solipsism that he actually mentions in here, so maybe I'll read what he says. And then we have the word idealism that's also very similar to mind only. And then we also have a term nominalism. It's maybe on the, like a philosophical term too. And I think it means like things are merely names. Johnny knows these things. Does that sound about right? Which is also, these things are all very similar to mind only, right? Nominalism are like, when we, this is a stick, it's only the name stick. Is similar, but now they get into pointing out the differences between these three and between mind only. So, Jeffrey Hopkins says, types of idealism need to be distinguished. I use the term idealism only to mean the absence of external objects. More specifically, that an object such as blue does not exist as a separate entity from a consciousness apprehending blue, and that a consciousness apprehending blue does not exist as a separate entity from that blue. This is the kind of sentences he writes. This is one of the easier ones. But that's idealism, right? That's how he's defining idealism, as the absence of external objects, or more specifically, that an object such as blue, the color blue, does not exist as a separate entity from the consciousness apprehending blue, and vice versa. That's how he's defining idealism. This is sometimes called subjective idealism in European and American philosophy. It's important to note that subjective idealism in this Buddhist system does not entail that all objects are the same entity as one particular subject, and does not entail solipsism. That's a nice simple way of saying solipsism is that all objects are the same entity as one particular subject, meaning like this mind is the source of, like there's nothing but this one mind, my mind, me is God, basically. I'm the only one in the universe and everything else is my dream. That's solipsism. But his technical way of putting it is kind of nice, the way he uses language to say this. Solipsism is that all objects are the same entity as one particular, in boldface, subject. So he's saying there are other consciousnesses and their perceptions. That keeps it from being solipsism. Such idealism also does not necessitate the positing of a permanent, pure consciousness that is the ultimate truth or absolute reality. He's saying, there, elsewhere, I think he says, there's lots of Indian teachings that posit this kind of thing, like a permanent, pure consciousness that is the ultimate truth or absolute reality that creates everything. Atman, yeah, Atman.
Kind of yogic. That's
in
yoga.
Yeah, in yoga. and Atman or Brahman as the creator consciousness of the universe, something like that. And we talked about some of these things too in the session on this very mind is Buddha, the view of Shrenika. I don't know if anyone even remembers that one. Shrenika, this Indian philosopher who said, the way I see it is like there's this one pure mind that isn't born and die, doesn't die when the body is born and dies, this one mind doesn't. And that, and then Dogen also quotes all these Zen teachers who say things like that, and then he proceeds to destroy them. So there's not one essential, pure, indestructible mind, although we do have the thoroughly established character that exists in permanent and everlasting time. And then a nice part of that, this book, is it's got this whole section called Thoroughly Established Nature Endowed with Buddha Qualities, which is this, you know, the sutra doesn't get into this, but later tradition use this idea of the thoroughly established character, which is the absence of our imagined projection of externality in the soup. It started saying that absence, that unfindability, that emptiness actually is endowed with Buddha qualities. Weird. So we won't get into that right now, but he goes into, I think he's somewhat curious about this, and I think he generally tries to refute most of their views that there could be such a thing, or at least looks at them very kind of critically. But it's a way of talking about Buddha nature, this term Buddha nature. Now, to avoid going too far down the path of heavy-duty scholastic philosophy during Sesshin, let me bring up some Dogen. Our cherished Zen school that the separate transmission outside the scriptures pointing directly to the human mind and becoming Buddha as Bodhidharma defined the Zen way. So Dogen's got this fascicle called A Painting of a Rice Cake, Shobogenzo Gabyo, and based on this idea, this old story, not story really, some more like a phrase, that painted rice cakes do not satisfy hunger. This might even be pre-Buddhist or some old Indian teaching, I don't know where it comes from, but the idea is that painted rice cakes is like all ideas, thoughts, and written words about reality don't satisfy hunger. We have to actually eat a real rice cake to satisfy hunger. So it's kind of like the Zen thing of like the separate transmission outside the scriptures, because sutras, the scriptures, can't really satisfy hunger. They're just paintings of a rice cake or of something that's very, very nourishing. So the phrase is when maybe kind of poking it at scholars saying, what are you doing there absorbed in your book? Painted rice cakes don't satisfy hunger. You should come to the Zen temple and sit on a cushion and put down that book. So painted rice cakes don't satisfy hunger. It's a nice phrase. Yes, Johnny.
Correct or wrong, or does he also say, however, the painting of a rice cake satisfies the painting of hunger?
Yeah, so now this is...
rice cake satisfies the idea of hunger.
Dogen, of course, is not just going to let a phrase like that go as it's usually interpreted. So, exactly. He's going to turn it. And so in terms of mind only, we can say the rice cake is the soup. What kind of soup is it?
Potato and...
What?
Energy.
It's an energy soup.
Oh, energy soup.
The rice cake is to call it potato soup. There's an energy soup, and it's completely inconceivable and indescribable, and it's constantly satisfying our hunger, and if we have a spoonful, without making it into anything, it's just, it's delicious beyond delicious. And then a painting of that is all this stuff, well, all these teachings about it, and all this talk about it, but also, it's the imagined world of externality. It's a thing, objects appear as external to mind. If the soup is the rice cake, then picking out all the potatoes and split peas and carrots and calling them like things that exist, individual entities, not just in the soup, or individual entities outside the mind. The energy soup is, I think, also good to remember. That's mind. It's not an external soup. And you could say, but because it's inconceivable, we're part of it, we're in the soup, conventionally speaking. But the soup is in us. There's complete interpenetration, right? It's inconceivable. But anything we put outside as an object is a painted rice cake. or you could also say painted rice cakes are like concepts. So the realization of mere concept is like the realization of a painted rice cake. And it's not about eliminating mere concepts or concepts. It's just by realizing that it's all mere concept. I mentioned this before, right? It's just realizing the mereness of concepts, or that anything we possibly can ever think about a rice cake, even if we're eating one, is a painting of a rice cake. But therefore, it's not about eliminating the painting, which it sounds like in the first original phrase that, painted rice cakes don't satisfy hunger. So Dogen says you should examine a painted Buddha and examine a painted rice cake. When you penetrate this matter, the coming and going of birth and death is a painting. Unsurpassed enlightenment is a painting. It's not like, well, we have unsurpassed enlightenment and then there's we have a painting of it. Unsurpassed enlightenment is a painting. The entire phenomenal universe and the empty sky are nothing but a painting. Since this is so, there's no remedy for satisfying hunger other than a painted rice cake. Phew. Without painted hunger, you never become a true person. There's no understanding other than painted satisfaction. In fact, satisfying hunger, satisfying no hunger, not satisfying hunger, and not satisfying no hunger, cannot be attained or spoken of without painted hunger. For some time, study all of these as a painted rice cake.
You know, I can imagine when he first delivered this, that the monks would break out uproarious laughter.
Maybe.
Because I think what he's trying to convey is so simple, and yet it gets so tangled up in all of this conceptual stuff. It has to be funny.
Stars' mind is just stars.
Yeah, I'm in the experience. I'm in star mind.
Mm-hmm.
Or paint. You know, if the world, if my reality becomes paint, I think that's what I'm hearing. If my reality becomes starness, then I just am. There's no separation. But, and it's just the context.
Yeah, yeah. So we were talking about how Dogen often does that. He, instead of making it pure subjectivity, he makes it pure objectivity. And we have Zen ways of playing with this kind of thing, like Dongshan's five ranks, we could say, get into this, and Linji's four phrases of guest and host, get into this. And so I don't remember exactly how Linji does this, but I think that's what I thought of when you were saying this, is that it's like, I think one of them is like, you take away the host and the guest are like subject and object, but like you take away the person but not the object is one of these relationships to the world, and then another one is you take away the object but not the subject. And then one is you take away the subject and the object, so that and that they're all liberating function, and and I tend to think that actually they're not that different. Like you can, like to say mind only is really emphasizing that there's nothing out there, but the other way that you could say subject only. School would say there's nothing in here, and it's not in terms of the experience. It's a shift of perspective, like those you know, the painting of a vase that's two faces, you know, and you can see it either way, but it's really the same picture. I think it's kind of like that, like this, the same liberating function is the case, and the point being that in both cases it's non-dual. In both cases, as long as you have a subject here and an object here, it's duality and it's painful and it's can't ever really resolve anything in such a situation. But if you take away one side, it's now we have non-duality. But then you take away the other side, that's also non-duality. And you see, take away both, that's another way of looking at it, too. non-duality, that's like
non-thinking,
yeah, when there's not even a sense of either, yeah, maybe we could say like non-thinking, there's just the mind, nothing is being produced anywhere, but it starts to sound kind of like nihilistic or like there's nothing at all. Mm-hmm.
One can hear, it's all concept. And so then dualistic mind takes that non-dualistic teaching and goes, therefore concept bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And
I think that's what the value of like the five ranks and these various formulations is, that it shows us that really it is, they are all true, but not in a kind of a pablum, way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean by that? Like there's that tendency to go, oh, it's all true, then nothing matters. And it's like, no, it does matter. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter, and it does matter. that's where the liberation is.
And there's all these permutations.
Is the non-grasping, the willingness, the ability to move, keep. It's like dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dynamic quality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't get stuck in any side. And I think that's what Dogen's doing, like this, why he's, you know, they say he's reinterpreting mind only. He's just always trying to have a fresh perspective and say, I don't think he's like criticizing, my guess is that he wouldn't say mind only is wrong. He's saying, oh, that's great. And now like, let's, you know, I'm not just going to repeat the same old mind only thing. We've already heard that. Let's see let's like talk about it from the other side, just to like, whoa. I thought I had this mind only thing down. Now you're saying that the star's mind is just the stars?
Well, because otherwise we start creating a fixed identity around the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the Zen sickness kind of idea.
Yeah.
You know, as you can, oh, emptiness. Now you're going to bludgeon people with emptiness.
Yeah. Yeah, at least there's the danger of getting stuck in any position. And I think that's why there's, you know, Zen has things like the five ranks that are, or you know, the five, more like five positions or permutations of the relative and ultimate, how they work together, just to keep our mind flexible and unstuck. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that all these constructions, the kinds of things that Kathy was talking about, is, you know, getting fixed on, they demand practice. They demand practice, and that. Ultimately, even though all these can be very elegant paintings, ultimately they're only resolved through practice, which is inexpressible, I think.
What is practice?
Well, for example, there's a mood practice, which is basically nothing is valid. And then you have this other practice, which I think maybe is mine always pointing to, where it's nothing is invalid. Now they appear to be contradictory. But in the practice, in our practice of sitting, in our practice of shikantaza, they're the same. Where nothing is valid, nothing is invalid, the same. There is an experience that is, the experience that arises, that's all I'll say about that, in the practice itself, which resolves these issues in a kind of non-conceptual way, I think. But there are hang-ups, which might be the beginning of the point of practice. Absent practice, we come up with these concepts and we say, okay, well, let's start here. Let's start at nothing is valid, let's start at everything is valid. But ultimately they get resolved in our practice.
Yeah, we have to practice. And I think if we're trying to summarize these schools with a one sentence thing, I think that's nice to do those exercises. I would say it like that if, you know, if we say that that the Madhyamaka emptiness approach is nothing's valid, I would say for mind only, instead of saying nothing's invalid, I would say instead of saying nothing's valid, I would say nothing's out there. That's like the difference between those. That they're both in a way about nothing, but one's about nothing's valid. And one's about the relationship to inside and outside. But that just came to mind. Mm-hmm. But the point about practicing and Zazen, we talk about in so many ways, but I think we can really explore some of these things in a really experiential way when we're sitting and we notice stuff happening, like suffering or the wall that we're looking at. You know, we can really, without thinking too much about it, hopefully, we can, you know, we've heard all this stuff now, we can just start exploring, like, is that wall that I'm looking at? What makes me think that it's external, or is it actually external? And we can get into reasonings and stuff, but just start opening to the fact that, like, I can start to open to how my perception is creating a wall out of the energy soup that I'm sitting in. So I think you could say that's somewhat conceptual. I think it is somewhat conceptual. So if Zazen is really just any conceptual thinking, drop it, then we can't do that kind of thing. But if it's playing with conceptual thinking as painted rice cakes that can actually satisfy painted hunger without getting too anxious and discursive, but more experientially examining, investigating, without a lot of words, maybe even just keep looking at the wall and or feeling the body and the, you know, pain in the legs or whatever, and like external to mind, or you know, really like the relationship of subject object, we can investigate without a lot of words, I think, and really start exploring it, and it's very interesting.
There was along these lines, there was an experience I had here a few days ago where I was in a sense, one of the deep senses of everything is one, and there was a great peace and great solidity, and then somebody sneezed. And I just about launched out of my seat. You know? And at first there was a kind of irritation, like, oh, damn. Then I realized that all of that was inside of me. That all that energy went full like this, and it became funny. And luckily, well, also, I guess the icing on the cake is that about that same time, the kids started laughing outside. Mm. So it was all very wonderful. But there was no doubt that the sneeze was in me. There's no doubt what had happened. That my whole body just went kaboom like this.
And often that's in the Zen stories, in the Zen awakening stories. It's isn't it interesting that they almost never say like he was deeply in samadhi, let go of all thought, and boom, he had a great realization. You never hear a story like that. It's always like he was talking to somebody in words, in painted words, and probably in a very concentrated state, and the person said something, or maybe think of it as someone sneezes, or there's the classic stories, the pebble hits the bamboo, or they see the peach blossoms. Like, it's all those things are about relationship to an apparently external world that trigger these people into non-separation. So if we think, if I can just stop all my thinking completely, that will be it. I don't know about that. Did you have something?
Yeah, well, Chris? I'm going to see if it's kind of attached, kind of connected to something that Kathy was saying. I hope I can trace it back. I know I can only trace it back so far. How do we attain liberation from suffering caused by concepts, even though the suffering caused by attachment to concepts, even though the notion of concepts is flipping back and forth between something you an example of how the concept is this, but then it's that, but then it's this. And
it's black, it's white, it's black and white, it's neither black and white, it's black and white,
right.
White and black.
So it's always, I mean, if that, the idea of making that differentiation was supposedly something that was helping us gain some clarity and thereby supposedly reducing some suffering. But we're still attached to the concepts of black or white or black and white. That was supposed to be liberated somehow, or give some clarity.
Well, you know, I think you said it when you caught it yourself, because first you said how do we get liberated from these concepts? And then you corrected yourself and said, oh, I mean liberated from attachment to the concepts. And that's the key point. Because so we can still relate to concepts, but without attaching to them. And it's like, oh, it's black now. Oh, okay, it's black. And they say, oh, actually, it's white. If we're not attached to black, it's like, okay, it's white now.
Right.
No, I was just kidding, it's black. Okay, it's black. If we're really not attached, it's like, okay. And I think the only way to be, completely not attached is to see that they're mere concepts. We think, well, they're concepts, but they're like really about reality. But if we see that actually they're merely concepts, that I think that language also brings forth this thought that you can't attach to a mere concept, I think, by definition, right? If it's merely a concept, and we know that it's merely a concept, or that it's just a painting of a rice cake, then actually we can't attach to it. But if we think it's really a rice cake, then we think we can attach to it. So almost to see that all of this stuff is painting, it sounds at first like the opposite. No, we want to see that it's not. We want to see what's truly not a painting, the reality, but that's where we actually grasp. Kind of strange, the opposite of what we might think.
So you're attaching to a mere concept. So you sort of have to back up.
No, I think you can't attach to a mere concept.
Oh, you attach to a concept.
To a kind of reified concept. That's like a concept that we think is not merely actually a concept. We think a concept that seems to be more than a concept, seems to be actually real. Like I can attach, like there's a concept stick here, but I don't see it as a mere concept. I see it as like actually a stick.
The attachment to the attachment.
What would that be?
Can you do it by incremental decreases? You look at all these wild thoughts going on, and then you cut them to, okay, it's just a concept.
Mm-hmm.
And then, okay, now I'm attached to the concept. And how do I cut the attachment to the attachment? Can you do that incrementally?
What?
Can you reduce your, it's okay now, here I am attached to the concept of attachment.
I think we do have layers and layers upon attachments upon attachments.
What would be some incremental steps?
So you could say sometimes it may work incrementally like this, but I think, especially in Zen, the approach is just like cut the root. There's all these like, there's a root and there's all these like branches of like extensions of flowering leaves and branches, and instead of like trimming them one by one till you get down to the root, we just say like.
Well, that's theoretically that's.
Well, in
it's
a way.
It's not theoretical.
Well, I think ultimately attachment as a process, attachment as a practice, as it works for me, is actually a deliberate denial of impermanence. Deliberate denial of dependent co-arising. And it's fixed because I'm saying it's permanent. And it is out there and it has independent existence. So ultimately, I think if there is an incremental thing, and for me, it's like, it's impermanent. That might be a way to shade it. Something with really like body pain, there, it seems so real, it seems so unending, and yet it's impermanent. And part of co-arising is like, it can begin to dissolve as I realize that it's also my interaction with it that's intensifying. So there is an incremental way in which it can happen, almost through a kind of mantra, but I think ultimately an attachment is a deliberate denial of impermanence, a deliberate denial of dependent co-arising.
I know that the concept of denial actually comes up when you're bound to that thought.
I think denial is a practice. I think denial for me is a...
So now you're extending it. I'm trying to reduce it. How do you cut the attachment? If you can't say that it's held together by three knots, you have to take all three knots apart.
Well, another way to, maybe this isn't exactly incremental, but you could say like, if we feel like, the cut the root thing sounds good, but like, I'm like I'm not ready for that, or like I'm too caught up in stuff. You could say, first we could do the practice of actually relaxing. Like, I'm not going to cut any roots here, but like I'm so caught up in this, in all these branches and stuff. First of all, I'm like, and my whole body is like, oh my God, I'm gonna. So first of all, okay, first let me just like take a really deep breath. Okay, incremental. What's it?
There's two monologues going on here. I'm only interested in one, to tell you the truth.
There's only one, actually. It's right now.
There's editorializing. I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Well, this is, there's only this right now.
Sorry?
There's only this right now.
Yeah, this is only one.
So, we just relax.
Just relaxing.
And then once we're relaxed, then we can start to see the situation. And then we can start to maybe see the root that could be cut. But I think the thing about not, sometimes it seems like we can think of incremental as like, first I have to work out all this other stuff before I really practice. Sometimes we think like that, like in all kinds of ways. Like I can't even like come to the Zendo until I work out this stuff in my life. Maybe that's not such a good example because that's not so direct either, but more like I'm really getting caught up in this situation here and it's really bothering, and like, so let me, you know, maybe like with another person, like we're having an argument or we're in some conflict with another person, like first let's try to use some nonviolent communication and these, all these wonderful skills, and let's like try to work out some of the specifics of this situation and let's agree on terms and stuff. Or we could just, sometimes it is helpful to do that. Sometimes we can cut the root, which means like right in the middle of the argument, we just suddenly like, whoa, actually I'm getting caught in this argument because I think that person is not my mind.
I like the idea, when you said relaxing, that made me think, well, maybe it's not necessary to cut it, but you can resolve it.
It's stopping that.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Cutting doesn't have to be.
Sanding it down. Stopping is the same way as just yanking out the root. I don't know how to yank out the root.
It's not a
root. Whatever metaphor you have.
I like the dissolution thing. That
whatever works for you.
Addresses.
Yeah. But I think your point that it's a non-doing. If cutting sounds like a little too much, like you have to like, the, you know, that root's so thick, it's like it's not an effortful thing. Yeah, that the cut is like, it's like if, you know, if your scissors were like razor blade sharp, so you just, but you don't even have to move to do it, because it's a non-doing. It's just like drop off. Body and mind.
Because to me, this is real stuff. I mean, you get emotionally entangled with stuff. It's like, how to cut those concepts?
Yeah.
The attachment to the concept. Mm-hmm. Real world things that really mess up my mind.
Yeah, of course, for all of us, yeah. So, and another way to see it, well, you cut the root with seeing. I mean, you can talk about cutting, dissolving, sanding, hammering, but relaxing, but you know, all these words of mind only and stuff, I think are designed to be able to start learning how to cut with seeing, how, you know, insightfully mind seeing how it is, like sudden, you know, like we're getting into an argument and all of a sudden I see because my storehouse consciousness is now filled with all these mind-only ideas. I remember, even in the heat of the argument, oh wait, actually, you're my mind. Then all of a sudden, without saying relax, all of a sudden we relax. Like, or something, everything shifts. Maybe the energy has its momentum, so maybe we're not totally relaxed, but suddenly everything's different. And we're still maybe arguing, but like, oh, but now that argument just became fun because, the mind is having an argument with itself. How amazing. So that's like through, without any special physical techniques. It's just like through insight into like non-externality. So I think, you know, these discussions, I think are, I hope, they're changing us. Even though we still have lots of doubts and we're like, it's complicated and confusing, are in terms of the school, it's like there's a storehouse consciousness that's getting like infiltrated slowly with these new strange ideas that that there's nothing out there, and those things are planted in there, and according to this teaching, it's like they don't disappear, they're like planted in this ground, an inconceivable soup of the storehouse consciousness. And but they're there ready to, the more that are planted there, the more that can sprout from that ground when they're needed, till eventually we like fill the whole storehouse consciousness with these wisdom seeds, we could say. And so the only thing that can ever sprout is beneficent wisdom seeds. And then they say, then the school gets into this weird thing about how they call the transformation of the basis, and the basis means the storehouse consciousness. It's like overturned. It's not just filled with good seeds. In the end, when it's really full of good seeds, it's like dumped out. It's overturned. It's like, and it no longer is the storehouse consciousness. The soup is no longer the soup. At the end, in this model. In the end, the soup gets poured out, and all that's left is perfect mirror. Just whatever is placed before it is reflected without any karmic stuff. But that's a story I don't want to get too into yet, because that's one of the weirder ones.
What's the concept to get all this stuff? I'm just trying to cut myself loose from those kinds of things.
So can you imagine how there's nothing, how it could be the case that me talking to you right now is actually not outside your mind?
Can I imagine the case that it is not outside my mind?
Yeah, that actually what you think of as me talking to you is a mental projection of what we call your mind.
Well, I guess on the one hand, I don't have enough stuff in my storehouse.
Yeah. That's why I keep going on for so long, even though, excuse me, but
well,
yeah, I'm trying to... Yeah, it's all about repetition. And discussion. I think it's good that we can like talk, converse about these things, and keep bringing up doubts and clarifying, trying to clarify and working it out. And, you know, I feel like I'm working it out with you all too. And it's a long process. But three times?
Three kalpas.
Three kalpas, yes. Yeah. Three kalpas, or, you know, three kalpas is a painted rice cake. So, three painted rice cakes.
Or no painted rice cakes, or three rice cakes and one rice cake?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, you... Painted silliness.
I know it's part of my mind. I get silly too. And offensive. And that's part of my mind. Yeah, that too. I get silly.
Yes.
I just want to make a very brief comment. Just about this process of understanding and listening, because I think it's... There's a lot of energy that comes up of our, you know, we've got these concepts and this dharma and our own, you know, kind of passion of grappling.
We're trying to work it out.
And I think it's really so helpful and so lovely it's like there's this image over here. Oh, that, you know, that turns my understanding a little bit, and then Kokyo says something, and that turns my understanding, or not. But I think it's a very rich, helpful thing that, you know, we're all here, kind of listening and receiving each other's energy of working with it.
Yeah.
And I just think it's interesting and helpful how, you know, for me, the energy soup really helps not getting there. And for somebody else, like Chuck, it's like, I gotta leave the room when you start talking about soup. So I think it's a lovely song, I think.
Yeah. We're explorers on this foggy, overgrown path, like helping each other explore and wanting to, like, I think it's like bodhicitta, wanting to like keep trying to see it in new ways. And it's like our that natural curiosity is almost like kind of bodhicitta. And also, there's this other level where even if everything we say is totally confused and it's just making us more confused, it's like all this is like an enactment of a painted rice cake. It's just like, it's all mere concept, and it's just like a dance. Because in the end, energy soup is also kind of like just the magical dance of the universe that's just like doing its thing, and it's not going anywhere, and it's not actually trying to do anything in particular. It's just expressing itself, and there's this, and dependent co-arising is like that, and the storehouse consciousness could say is it doesn't have a will of its own. It's just receiving everything that's coming into it and sending out what's in it, like due to conditions. There's nobody behind the wheel at the control panel. And it's kind of like, I feel like in a group Dharma discussion like this, it's kind of like an enactment of that sometimes. It's like, we're just doing this thing. We don't know where it's going. And I guess piece of the soup.
I just wanted to say that I on the kind of this level, I think it would be very helpful today if we had 10 minutes of kinhin before service and lunch, so that people could have a chance.
Yeah.
We need to go to the restroom, and so we could have time to prepare the altar for service. And so I just wanted to say, if we want to do that, that would be in a few minutes from now.
Sounds good.
And Edie had a question.
Oh, Edie had a question. No, we can do it. I'll give a short answer to a long question.
I think I wanted to check out if what I'm thinking about is what you're saying, because I see a tree outside the second floor of my house, and in December it's in full bloom. It's glorious colors of reds and oranges. And I think it's there just for me, because I'm the only one that can see it. It's just right in my face on the second floor of my house. And it's there just for me. And other days when I'm in the room and I'm working and I'm concentrating on something, it's not even in my consciousness, because I'm not aware of it. Focused on something. And then some days it's just amazing, and that's all I can experience. And I'm not even there, you know. I'm there, but it's not like it's my tree.
When you're doing something and you don't even notice it's there, it's like it's really not there.
And sometimes it's so beautiful, I'm not there.
And in a way,